Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy, your host for Healthcare and Its Future. My guest today is Dr. William B. Isaacs, the interim director of the Johns Hopkins Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute. Dr. Isaacs is the interim director at the world's first institute dedicated solely to bladder cancer. As interim director, Dr. Isaacs, one of the world's foremost authorities in hereditary prostate cancer research, will lead the Institute's search for a permanent director, issue grants aimed at translating research discoveries to better patient care, raise public awareness about bladder cancer and the BCI, and garner funding for the Institute. Dr. Isaacs retains his positions as professor of urology and oncology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the William Thomas Gerard Mario Anthony Duhon and Jennifer John Chalsty, Professor of Urology. Isaacs, a graduate of Gilman here in Baltimore, received his undergraduate degree at Brown University before completing his doctorate at Johns Hopkins University in the Department of Pharmacology and Molecular Science. Dr. Isaacs, who has a background spanning more than 30 years at Johns Hopkins, joined the faculty of the Department of Urology in 1988, where he has since made great strides in the fields of urology and oncology research. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Doctor.
Thank you, Dave.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, a little short bio there.
So you covered a lot of ground there. So actually, as you mentioned, I grew up in Baltimore. I was actually born up the street here at Johns Hopkins Hospital. My parents came to Baltimore from Ohio after World War II, as my father was a medical student at Hopkins and then went on to be on the house staff with Alfred Blalock in the 50s. And so I was born here. My brother was born. So I haven't gotten very far away from the hospital.
So you can come home again.
Come up with something more imaginative. But in any case, so I've been at Hopkins after, as you mentioned, I finished college and had an opportunity to work as a technician in a laboratory in the urology department after I finished college. And I met an individual who had a lot of influence over myself and just my thoughts and my career, and that's Donald Coffey, who was head of urology research at Johns Hopkins. And so I ended up doing my dissertation with him. And actually, Don Coffey was interested in prostate cancer. Again, this was in 1977. At a time when people were just beginning to think about prostate cancer. And actually, there weren't very many people thinking about prostate cancer. It was not a well-known disease. It was a very common disease, but people didn't like to talk about it. There was very little research being done. There was very little funding for it. So I got very interested under his influence of prostate cancer and realized what a big problem it was. And so I was fortunate to come on the faculty in 1988, and Patrick C. Walsh was our chairperson at that point. And Dr. Walsh went on to modify the surgery for removing the prostate, the radical prostatectomy, and this coincided with the development of the PSA test as a screening test for prostate cancer. And so these two coincidental occurrences led to a huge influx of prostate cancer patients at Johns Hopkins and the radical prostatectomy as a major means of treatment of a very common cancer. So we got interested in what causes prostate cancer. And again, with Dr. Walsh, we were interested in hereditary aspects, you know, why some men are at increased risk. And so we've spent a tremendous amount of effort on actually making some progress in this area, reflected by the sort of worldwide progress that's been made in understanding the genome and individuals' DNA and how that contributes to disease in general and in cancer specifically for prostate cancer, but for all cancers and essentially all diseases. So I've been interested in urological research for my entire career. So when this opportunity came up, I was very interested in being part of this development in bladder cancer, and that's what we're doing right now.
For just 25 years involved with it, what major changes throughout? I mean, when you first started, how different is it? Briefly mentioned about it, but go in a little bit more detail about that.
There's been several changes that I think have been highly significant. Obviously, one is the technology to understand human biology or just biology in general. at a molecular level, all the molecular biology, their understanding of DNA, how it works, how it can be involved with disease processes, the cloning and the sequencing of the human genome in about 2001 was obviously a major milestone. And I think it's only been within the last 5 years that we've really begun to reap the rewards from understanding that sequencing effort. And now I think it's really the key to going forward for cancers, but also for understanding an inherited susceptibility and the whole idea that exposures to various agents or lifestyle issues are very important in perhaps setting the stage for the diseases that we have. But it's really an interaction of those lifestyle and exposure issues with the genome that really we think now determines in large part what diseases people get, and certainly cancer falls into that that category. So I think, again, just the molecular understanding of biology and biological processes has been so dramatic over the past 25 years. I would say that that's probably a major effort. I think we still have a long way to go, but we have a major milestone. We know all the sequence of the DNA, and that is just a tremendous stepping stone to go from there. I think the other aspect is just the general interest of people in their health, I mentioned prostate cancer. The idea that people didn't even like to talk about prostate cancer. You would even call it by a different name, like bone cancer, mm-hmm. if you had metastatic disease. And so now, obviously, I think a lot of those barriers that used to keep people from talking about their health have disappeared. I think people are very, very interested in their health. People are interested in living a long, healthy life. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are, and they want to do everything they can to ensure that. And I think that drives if there's a strong feeling about that in the country, I think that drives a lot of downstream events. The National Institutes of Health and their priorities about what they target. So I think the ability to maintain health, how to overcome disease when people are affected with disease. I think the whole idea of people being more in touch or more responsible mm-hmm. for their own health seems to me to be a major step in the right direction. And I think that will, in fact, continue to drive progress and funding and in terms of disease research.
Well, it's interesting to me because in 25 years, I know you've seen lifestyle changes. 25 years ago, there was a lot more smokers. People are, like you say, more aware of it. In terms of your research, 25 years you've been at the bladder cancer apex, maybe. We'll just say that for now. Okay. And you said just in the last few years things have happened. Is that in your experience generally how it works, really? I mean, it just things happen, and not like the discovery of penicillin or anything like that. But, you work and work and work for years, and then all of a sudden something happens, and then...
Right. And I think, so the bladder cancer issue is a very good one, I think, as an example. And I think that, unfortunately, bladder cancer is, I think, much more common than most people think. 70,000 individuals in the United States are diagnosed each year with bladder cancer. About 15,000 individuals die every year from bladder cancer. And yet, there is very little funding spent on it. Mm. There's disproportionately little research being done on bladder cancer, so it's really an issue that needs to be better funded, better studied, and really that's what this Johns Hopkins Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute is all about. And I think that you can see when there is interest generated. And that there is progress at the scientific level being made, that things will fall into place. And I think, again, going back to sort of the prostate cancer story, that what that's taught us is, again, I think the idea of a disease which was being treated the same way for many years, not very effectively, and then Again, due to this sort of confluence of events, particularly a PSA test and a different way to treat the disease, it becomes very much in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that had, direct consequences. And people like Mike Milken and the Prostate Cancer Foundations get started and the word gets out. People start talking about the disease people that have the disease, public figures. Schwarzkopf, Bob Dole, all these folks came on TV and talked about the fact they had prostate cancer. So they made it okay, to actually discuss this sort of cancer that people didn't want to talk about. And I think bladder cancer suffers from some of the same aspects of that. There's very little individuals or discussion sort of in the general public conversations about bladder cancer. And I think that's really what we need to establish. And women did for breast cancer, breast cancer was underfunded. Women organized, groups organized. They went to Capitol Hill. They made their voices heard, and things changed. And now there's millions of dollars at the United States government, as well as many foundations, are pouring into breast cancer research, and the same for prostate.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a tremendous increase in the amount of research dollars invested in prostate cancer research, and there's been tremendous progress made. Bladder cancer has not seen that, and I think that's again what Erwin and Stephanie Greenberg, who are the individuals who made this institute possible, along with the commitment from Johns Hopkins. I think that's what their intention was, to more or less put bladder cancer on the map. This is a major problem. It affects many people, both their individuals who have the disease, their family members, quality of life, death from the disease. It's a bad thing. And we need to focus on it. We need to it's not going to go away. You mentioned smoking. Smoking is one big thing that we can do. Reducing smoking smoking is a key contributor to bladder cancer. About half of bladder cancer cases are thought to be due pretty much directly to cigarette smoking, and that can be reduced. But we really don't understand a lot about bladder cancer. We certainly do not know how to treat it very effectively, how to cure it, and these are all issues I think that we can address. And just to go back to your question about how this happens, it happens by people becoming aware, realizing the magnitude of the problem, and realizing that it's not hopeless, that things can be done if you direct funding at them and efforts at them. People are extremely talented when they put their minds to things, and that's what we need to do here for bladder cancer.
So let's just talk a little bit about diagnosis. Is there an age range that is more liable to get bladder cancer? And then what do you look for?
Well, cancers in general are typically higher. Obviously, there are many childhood cancers as well. But on a numerical basis, cancers are really a disease of aging. And certainly for bladder cancer, it's disproportionately affects the elderly population. And so it's a major problem in older age groups. That doesn't mean you can't get bladder cancer early, but typically it occurs much more commonly in older individuals. Bladder cancer, there's a number of signs. For example, if you have blood in the urine, hematuria, that's probably the most common sign. Unfortunately, there's a lot of things which can result in blood in the urine. But if you have that, that is an indication that you may, in fact, have bladder cancer, and it needs to be addressed and worked up by a physician that can get to the bottom of what that problem is. Pain on urination or changes in sort of urinary frequency and things of those nature are also some of the most common warning signs of bladder cancer. So the diagnosis is typically, as a result of some symptoms mm-hmm. that the patient actually has. There is not widespread screening just in general for bladder cancer. However, if you have these If you have these symptoms, then there are several approaches that are used to understand whether or not you have bladder cancer. Certainly, you can look at the urine, the cells in the urine, and see if there are evidence of cancer cells, bladder cancer cells in the urine by cytology, just by looking at the cells there. And a pathologist who's trained in that fashion can tell just by looking at the cells whether or not you've got the cancer. And the more definitive way is actually to look in there with a cystoscope, which is a little scope that you can put up the urethra under anesthesia, and actually look all around in there. And that's one of the
Glad you put that last part in.
And so it's one of the few areas of the body. Obviously, there are other areas, but where you can actually look around and see what's going on. And then actually you can go in and if there's something that looks suspicious, need to be investigated further, you can take a piece of that tissue, take a biopsy, and then the definitive diagnosis can be made by a pathologist looking at this tissue.
When you get something like blood in the urine and you are diagnosed, this is maybe a specious question, but is it early enough for treatment in generally?
It certainly can be. Unfortunate situations, not all the time, not 100% of the time, but the majority of the time when individuals are diagnosed with bladder cancer, the prognosis is good. And again, this is the important part of the diagnosis to determine, how aggressive is the cancer that the individual may have. And there are very, very definitive ways to do that, both by looking at the grade of the tumors, that is what the cells actually look like under a microscope, and then also, how far along the tumor is. Is it just on the surface of the bladder? So the bladder is lined by a transitional epithelial cell layer, which is a very specialized set of cells, and oftentimes the cancers will be just in that layer. If they are beginning to invade in through the there's a muscle lining of the bladder, which is obviously key to its function to be able to contract. And if these epithelial cells, these cancerous epithelial cells, are now invading into that muscle, so that's muscle invasive bladder cancer. That's a much more ominous sign that you have an invasive disease, and that requires much more aggressive treatment.
In your 25 years, have you seen the treatment grow, and go a little detail about that?
I think that this is one of the problems that we have is that the treatments have not really gotten log orders better like you might expect, and not like you've seen for other for prostate, breast, colon cancers. There has not been the same extent of progress that's been made in the treatment of bladder cancer. My primary focus is on prostate. And so forgive me if I don't know some of the details of the bladder cancer situation. But my understanding is, so there's only a 3 or 4 drugs that are FDA approved for bladder cancer. It's a very small number of drugs. That number has not really changed dramatically over the past years. And again, this is in contrast to prostate cancer. There are 20 drugs and a whole series of new drugs which have just within the last couple of years been approved by the FDA for treatment for prostate cancer. And I'm sure the same things are true for breast and colon. Bladder cancer has not seen those types of progress, those types of steps, and improvements made in the treatment. And that's really, again, I think one of the major reasons for creating this institute is to draw attention to that and create an entity in which one of its major goals is to perfect and make progress in the treatment of this disease.
So, well, let's talk about that a bit now, the Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute. It's less than a year old. Go into a little history about how that came about.
Right. So I don't know all the details, but I do know that Erwin and Stephanie Greenberg have a history, long history of philanthropic endeavors and have been interested in cancer for many years. Erwin has been on the advisory boards for the Hopkins Cancer Center, and Stephanie Greenberg has been involved in Swim Across America. And so they've had a long-term interest, a variety of charitable and philanthropic efforts, and certainly cancer has been one of them. And so they became interested, particularly interested in bladder cancer, and I believe it was in last spring. They made this interest known to the folks at Hopkins, from President Daniels and Bill Nelson, who's head of the Cancer Center, Ted DeWeese, and the folks at Hopkins. And I think that they came forth and wanted to do something for bladder cancer. And I think that working with the folks at Hopkins, they put together this idea of creating a very novel approach and of having a dedicated institute for bladder cancer. And this is really something that has never been done before. There is no, as far as we know, any institute that's been created and is dedicated solely to bladder cancer research, treatment, progress in treatment, and education. So so the idea was, how could they come together and create a situation that really focused a light on bladder cancer? And I think this is what they came up with. And I think it's, you know, it's a fantastic opportunity. And I have great optimism for this being a major, have a major impact on the bladder cancer field.
That's terrific. I mean, it's only been open since May, but talk about some of the programs and the activities and what's going on.
Right. And so you're certainly correct. We are just getting started with this effort. You know, again, my focus, along with Carla McClintock, our administrator for this institute, you know, so our job is to several things. We One of our main jobs is to find the permanent director. So as you mentioned at the outset, I'm the interim director, and it's certainly a privilege for me to be able to do that. You know, we're very interested in getting the permanent director in place so that the institute can take off in earnest. And so that we've got some of the best researchers and clinicians in bladder cancer in the world that are interested in this position. So we are in the process now of going through that, of finding the permanent director. The other aspects of what we're trying to do is to make people aware of the Bladder Cancer Institute. And for this, I thank you for the opportunity to use this particular occasion to talk about the Bladder Cancer Institute. And we have some other approaches with folks to try to increase the visibility of the Bladder Cancer Institute and bladder cancer in general. And again, as you mentioned, the other very important aspect that we've been involved in is to send out a request for applications for funding for research grants. So, and again, this is a cornerstone of the institute, with the idea being that anybody in the world, wherever they are, can apply to the Johns Hopkins Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute for funding, so that we can take advantage of and try to unite researchers all over the world to advance the state of the art of bladder cancer diagnosis and treatment. And and we've actually have successfully completed our first round of funding. We funded several investigators. We have some of the world's best researchers at Johns Hopkins already. And we funded several of those. And we also funded individuals at University of Chicago, University of Colorado. And so this is our first year of getting this funding going. We think we have some very innovative and potentially high impact research that we're funding. And we certainly look forward to continue that very important program, again, as a very important aspect of the Institute to fund the progress that can be made is very directly linked to discovery of understanding bladder cancer in a way that will allow us to better, again, diagnose it, management, and treat it.
It's brilliant. Where exactly are you located here in Baltimore?
We are at Johns Hopkins Hospital. The Bladder Cancer Institute does not currently have dedicated space. So right now it's spread out over the departments of urology, oncology, radiation oncology, pathology, immunology. However, I believe in 2016 or 2017, there is a a very exciting transition that will occur, and that is there will be dedicated space for for the Bladder Cancer Institute on a new building, the Virag building, which is, I think, slated to begin construction relatively soon. And at that point, there will be an official site of the Bladder Cancer Institute. But again, it will really encompass individuals and researchers that are spread out across the institution and also across the United States and potentially the world.
Well, it's a perfect segue to my next question. Besides having a new building, what do you see the Institute in 3 to 5 years?
I am extremely optimistic about what can happen and the rate of change which the Institute may be able to foster. You know, Hopkins has a tremendous resource, obviously, for cancer research, and disease research in general, and there's a tremendous group of researchers there and clinicians there now. Noah Hahn, Trinity Bivalacqua is the leaders of the clinical side. So we have a tremendous group there. What I think the Institute will do is bring those folks together with a focal point to really accelerate progress in bladder cancer through communication, through funded research, through coordination of programs, educational programs, just talking among the researchers. And so I think that what I am hoping is that within 5 years, the Bladder Cancer Institute emerges as the world's leading center for bladder cancer research, management, treatment of the disease. It will be a mecca for patients. It will be the site that individuals who are interested in working on bladder cancer, both clinically and research-wise, will come to. I think it will be the the center of excellence worldwide for all things bladder cancer, and I expect that it will. You know, there is a tremendous amount that needs to be done, so it's not going to happen overnight in terms of coming up with a cure for this very bad disease. But I do think that what we've come to expect when if you put people together who are motivated, and we certainly know that the folks at Hopkins are motivated to do great things. But you also need to provide space. You need to provide resources, and I think that's what the Institute is going to really make concrete. It's a concrete step forward to those ends, and that's exactly what we need. We have the talent, and we want to get the young folks involved. Again, unless you have the ability to sort of make career possibilities evident for younger investigators, they can't afford to go into an area like bladder cancer. So I think this is going to change. So again, I have very big hopes for the Institute. And I really I think it will be the world's leading center for bladder cancer.
It's the strands of potential have got to be so exciting. Here's you 25 years. Did you ever think that it would come to this? I mean, you got to be excited yourself. In your lifetime, all this is going to happen, come to fruition at least.
Right. You know? I mean, I think it is so exciting. And I think that's why, even though, I've worked primarily on prostate cancer, but when I heard about the Bladder Cancer Institute, I was very excited, and I think that, and so it's very exciting for me, and I know Carla as well, just to be a part of the initial phases of this, and mainly because I think this is not sort of a mirage of any sort. It's actually a concrete step that in the right direction that can end up being a landscape changing event for this bladder cancer scourge.
Well, this is just an introductory. We can't cover everything, but I think people have gotten a good idea of what it's all about. It's very exciting. I mean, it's exciting for you. It's exciting for bladder cancer research. It's exciting for Baltimore, too. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I'd just like to, again, to thank you for this opportunity to try to get the word out about what's going on. This, again, we think very exciting opportunity for bladder cancer progress here in Baltimore as part of the Hopkins Institution. And Again, just to emphasize, it's really the work and the generosity of Erwin and Stephanie Greenberg that's making this possible, along with the commitment from Johns Hopkins. But really, it's their idea, their motivation. So I think we all owe them a debt of gratitude, and certainly, that is just a tremendous act that I have a tremendous respect for and want to thank them. And I just want to, again, thank you, Dave, for giving this, this opportunity.
Well, like I said, this is not a one-off, and I want you to come back and update us, and you'll have a link to this so people can see it 24/7.
Excellent.
So give us a little contact info.
So what we have, we're working on our website, and it should be up soon. And in the meantime, you can certainly contact us through email. And so the email address I'll give you right now, it's the initials of the Johns Hopkins Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute, or jhgbci@jhmi.edu. And there is a phone number if you want to, again, be in touch with us, of 443-287-0147. I think you'll get Carla if you call that number. Please let us know if you have questions or interests. We're putting together a mailing list for folks who are interested in the Institute, and we can certainly add you to that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming by. This is Dave Custy. You've been listening to Healthcare and Its Future on Baltimore Internet Radio. I've been talking to Dr. William B. Isaacs, the interim director of the newly launched $45 million Johns Hopkins Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute, the world's first institute dedicated solely to bladder cancer. Thank you very much.